Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from Stat. I'm Meg Terrell.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
And I'm Damian Garde.
It's Thursday, November 19th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
First, 90% is so last week. We dig into the new COVID-19 vaccine trial results from Moderna and Pfizer.
Then, as promised, we'll bring you a look at what's to come in health and medicine under President-elect Joe Biden with Stat Washington correspondent Lev Fasher.
Finally, our colleague Matt Herper will join us to share three of the most memorable moments from this week's Stat Summit.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Angus McCauley, the Chief Revenue Officer of Stat. The coronavirus pandemic has prompted the healthcare community to find new ways to help. The COVID-19 Plasma Alliance includes 13 companies developing a medicine made from plasma that may become an important COVID-19 treatment. I'm here with Julie Kim from Takeda, who co-leads the alliance. Julie, you're co-leading a global initiative to deliver a potential medicine in the fight against the pandemic. How can we each play our part?
Hi, Angus. Thanks for the question. The Alliance is developing a medicine called a hyperimmune that's made with convalescent plasma from people who survived COVID-19 because their plasma contains special antibodies that can fight off the disease. The more COVID-19 survivors who donate, the more medicine we can make. So if you've survived COVID-19, please consider donating. Your plasma could help others survive COVID-19 too. And if you've not had COVID-19 but know others who have, please help us spread the word. You can visit thefightisinus.org to find out more.
Monday morning, just as the sun was rising on the east coast of the U.S., the world was told a COVID-19 vaccine was strongly protective against the disease. Again.
More positive news for a coronavirus vaccine. This time, one has been shown to be 94.5% effective at preventing COVID-19 and doesn't need to be stored at such low temperatures.
This week, of course, it was Moderna, which was following Pfizer and BioNTech's interim results last week. The Moderna team showed 94.5% efficacy for their vaccine in preventing cases of COVID-19 and revealed more details. The vaccine also protected against severe disease and looked likely to protect across all age groups.
We talked with Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel Monday morning on CNBC about the results, and he specifically pointed to the potential for the vaccine to keep people from getting so sick they have to go to the hospital.
I think this is actually the data that excites me the most, Meg. Of course, we are delighted that the vaccine has close to 95% efficacy. But as you said, what we all want is if somebody gets infected, that they don't get severe disease.
Not to be outdone, Pfizer and BioNTech reported final efficacy results from their phase 3 just 2 days later, and that figure came up at 95%. For people over 65, it was 94%, and it showed strong protection against severe disease as well.
So it's been a good week, to say the least, and we should probably expect the final efficacy results from Moderna fairly soon as well. So just a quick explainer on what the difference is. Last week, Pfizer reported its first interim look at the trial, where they had 94 cases of COVID. The trial would be considered complete once they had 164 cases.
Yeah, and by the time they reported their final efficacy results on Wednesday, they had 170. And as our good friend and former co-host Rebecca Robbins wrote this week in the New York Times, you know, the terrible speed with which the coronavirus is spreading across the United States has a kind of a slender silver lining. It is actually hastening the testing of vaccines that could eventually end the pandemic. Hey, Rebecca.
So both Pfizer and Moderna say they'll submit applications soon to the FDA for emergency use authorization. Then the FDA will hold a meeting of outside advisors to pull apart every detail of the studies. And we learned the agency has asked those advisors to hold December 8th, 9th, and 10th for the meetings. And after that, they could greenlight the vaccines pretty quickly for market.
Another important detail we learned more about this week is what it will be like to actually get these shots. So though they're based on the same messenger RNA technology and their efficacy appears similar, at least from the data we've seen so far, Moderna's vaccine is a higher dose than Pfizer's, and they did report higher rates of things like severe fatigue, headache, muscle ache, and joint pain after people got their second shots of the vaccine.
Yeah, Pfizer also reported grade 3 fatigue and a headache for some participants. And to explain, grade 3 essentially means that these effects were so strong that they interfered with people's ability to do normal daily activities. But both companies say they typically don't last very long.
So folks in the public health world have said this raises questions about whether people would need to take a day off of work after vaccination, for example. All things we'll start to see get parsed out over the next weeks and months. And these kinds of tolerability issues have been compared to the shingles vaccine. It's not easy to take for everybody, but as public health experts would say, it's better than getting the disease.
Our work begins with getting COVID under control. We cannot repair the economy, restore our vitality, or relish life's most precious moments until we get it under control.
If somehow this podcast were your only source of information, you would have no idea that there was a U.S. presidential election earlier this month and that former Vice President Joe Biden won it. We're going to rectify that this week.
Yeah, Biden and his transition team have been busy since the networks called the race on November 9th. Here to update us on how the Biden-Harris administration is filling out is Stat Washington correspondent Lev Fasher. Lev, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Hey, everyone.
So Biden said throughout the campaign that dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic would be the most pressing day one job for the next president. So what has his transition team been doing in that department, and how might it differ from the Trump administration?
Right. So one thing that President-elect Biden said throughout the campaign was that we need to listen to scientists. He has really pledged for months now to elevate the voices of scientific experts, of epidemiologists, of public health officials, and really, especially career people who are not political appointees, but longtime staff scientists at federal agencies. We've already seen hints of that. For instance, we've already heard from Vivek Murthy, one of Joe Biden's top pandemic advisors and the former Surgeon General. There are several other high-profile people in his public health circle who've already been talking to reporters and doing press briefings here and there. So I think the biggest thing is just going to be communications and, really making sure that it's scientists and doctors who are getting the message out. Of course, that is a stark difference from the Trump administration, which has not had a COVID briefing in several weeks. And at this point, we really just don't hear President Trump or even Vice President Mike Pence talk about the pandemic at all.
So what kind of policy decisions are on the table when it comes to pandemic response? Like, I'm curious, how much can the White House really do about a problem that seems so dependent on state-by-state policies and decisions?
Right. So I think the big question is, will Joe Biden attempt to enact a national mask mandate? The answer is really no. He's said as much. He will ask governors and mayors and local health officials to enact mask mandates. He has a bit of power in terms of mask mandates in federal buildings around the country, a bit for interstate transportation. So maybe rest stops or, you know, if you ride Amtrak, maybe you'd have to wear a mask now. I think that's actually already in place. But you're right. A lot of this is state-based, and there really is only so much that a president can do when he inherits a pandemic, you know, and just these awful rates of new infections. We have no idea what things will look like come January 20th when he's inaugurated. But like I said, I think the biggest thing is just communications. I think a lot of public health officials would welcome maybe a more traditional PSA approach in terms of encouraging Americans to wear masks and practice social distancing. We saw a similar effort from HHS in recent months, but it kind of cratered, especially after a Wall Street Journal article about a quid pro quo between Santas and the federal government, wherein Santas would appear in PSAs telling Americans to behave pandemic-wise, and then they would get early access to a vaccine. So I think there is thought of a more straight-laced public messaging campaign.
So Lev, last week, Biden made his first major appointment by picking Ron Klain as his chief of staff. What should people know about Klain, and what does that appointment signal about the administration to come?
Ron Klain is a longtime aide to Joe Biden. He was his chief of staff as vice president, and then late in the Obama administration, 2014-2015, during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, he was designated what people refer to as the Ebola czar. So he was essentially an intra-government coordinator between various agencies and health officials and the WHO and foreign governments. He was not a trained pandemic response expert. He's not someone with a scientific or medical background, but he really, in the end, did get rave reviews for the Ebola response. And given that experience, a lot of public health experts in Biden's world are really thrilled that he's going to be essentially running Joe Biden's White House. He has the experience. He speaks the language. And people just see him as kind of exactly the right choice amid a pandemic, not necessarily for political reasons, but just because this is not his first time trying to coordinate a federal pandemic response.
There's also a lot of speculation among people in and around the pharmaceutical world about just what kind of relationship the next administration will have with the drug industry. Have you seen any clues as to how Biden perceives pharma?
I'll say this. When I talked to a lot of drug industry lobbyists prior to the election, this was exactly the dream scenario they laid out, a Joe Biden presidency that kind of gets away from Donald Trump's antagonism toward pharma and, frankly, unpredictability in terms of trying to regulate lower drug prices, but also a Republican Senate, which essentially means Congress is not going to be able to do anything aggressive or ambitious on any number of policy fronts, drug pricing included. Of course, there's still a very small chance Democrats get to 50 Senate seats if they win two runoff races in Georgia in January. That's seen as not really likely to happen. So I think hopes for sweeping wholesale drug industry and drug pricing reform were pretty much dashed by the election results. And in addition, Biden is not seen as one of the Democratic candidates' most antagonistic toward the industry. So there are some things he can do via executive action. It'll be interesting to see whether he keeps regulations proposing drug importation from Canada or indexing Medicare payments to price levels in foreign countries, particularly in Europe. Those are a couple signature Trump initiatives. But I don't think there's fear, as there had been prior to the election, that this is a worst case scenario for drug manufacturers on the pricing front.
So earlier this week at the STAT Summit, Dr. Anthony Fauci praised Operation Warp Speed, which is the Trump administration's initiative to speed up the development of vaccines and treatments for COVID-19. Do you have a sense as to whether Biden and his administration plans to keep Warp Speed and its leadership intact after inauguration?
I don't expect Biden to come in and dismantle Operation Warp Speed. I think regardless of whether this initiative is the way President-elect Biden and his advisors would have designed it, we're just kind of way too deep into it to reevaluate the project at its core level. I've heard a couple things. One, fascinatingly, is there are people in Biden's circle who don't love the branding Warp Speed. Of course, it's a Trump branding, so I don't know if there's politics involved there, but the concern I've had articulated to me is that Warp Speed does not actually instill confidence in the safety or efficacy of a vaccine. When people take a vaccine for an infectious disease, they don't want to hear that it was developed necessarily at warp speed. So I can see some sort of rebranding. I've also heard concerns about the degree of the military's involvement. This is a scenario where President Trump's refusal to concede the election and formally start the transition is actually really inhibiting the Biden folks because they don't have access to the state of play in terms of the organizational chart and in terms of details about manufacturing. So they're kind of trying to recreate some of this data the hard way by talking to individual drug companies, by talking to hospitals about ICU bed capacity. But this is an area in particular where I think it's hard to say until there's a formal transition. And we just haven't seen that type of cooperation yet from the Trump administration.
Lev, before we let you go, I just have one other quick question for you, which is something we talked about with Helen Branswell a few weeks back, sort of the future for Dr. Fauci. She thought, and we've heard from folks that, you know, his job might be in danger from President Trump doing kind of revenge firings of people who've angered him. You know, is Dr. Fauci safe because the president is focused on other things? Do you think we could still see something like that happen? And how important would that really be? Because it would be so difficult, presumably, for him to actually be fired in the time before the new administration would then come in.
Right. This is one of those things, I think, in the Trump era where any prediction you make runs the risk of making you look silly a few weeks later. Here's what I'll say. It is procedurally difficult for President Trump to actually fire Tony Fauci. He is someone who is appointed by the president. He was actually appointed by Ronald Reagan in the mid-80s. Technically, for Fauci to be dismissed from his position at NIH, it would require either the HHS secretary or NIH Director Francis Collins to dismiss him. I imagine that either of those people, especially Collins, would not be willing to do so, even if ordered by the president. And it could set up this really high profile showdown that I imagine would be largely irrelevant, because even if Fauci were reassigned, as we saw with Rick Bright, the BARDA director earlier this year, I can't imagine Joe Biden wouldn't just reappoint him on January 20th. So it's a moot point in a lot of ways. If it's a fight President Trump wants to pick, I guess at this point, nothing should really surprise us. I don't personally see it happening.
Well, Lev, thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys, as always.
It has been a particularly busy week at STAT, and not solely because of all the COVID vaccine news that we were discussing before, but because we're also putting on our annual STAT Summit.
Over the past 4 days, some of the smartest minds in science and medicine logged into Zoom and joined STAT reporters for revealing and smart conversations about how COVID-19 has reshaped the world and what's coming next.
Joining us now to recap some of the bigger moments from the STAT Summit is our colleague Matt Harper. Matt, in addition to all of his reporting duties, is also responsible for planning a lot of our events, including the STAT Summit. Matt, congrats on another great conference and welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here.
So on Tuesday evening, STAT executive editor Rick Burke sat down for an interview with Bill Gates, co-chairman of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. As you'd expect, the conversation focused on the development of vaccines against the novel coronavirus and the U.S. response to the pandemic, both domestically and internationally.
Bill praised Operation Warp Speed for helping to accelerate the development and testing of vaccines. He also expressed fears that the current plan to distribute vaccines might not work.
The whole infrastructure to do the distribution, I don't see that coming together in a rational fashion. You know, what's the role of the military in this? How different is the Pfizer approach than some of the others? How do you make it complementary? It's so cacophonous. It could work out in a decent way. It doesn't appear that it is. It appears that what we did on diagnostics, you know, we're sort of rerunning that playbook of everybody sees a little piece of it. So I'm worried about vaccine distribution not going to the right people and not going at full speed. I can't predict the numbers, but wow. It is a dysfunctional set of people right at the moment.
So, Matt, it's probably not surprising, but Bill praised the COVID-19 advisors that President-elect has chosen. But what else did he say about the incoming Biden administration?
Bill was actually praised the Biden administration, and Biden in particular, talking about how much Biden knows about science. He's made several comments about how, from Biden's work in cancer and other interactions with him, that he believed that this would be an administration that would really value science above other ways of looking at the pandemic.
So the summit also featured an interview with Tony Fauci conducted by STAT's Helen Branswell. Matt, what were some of the highlights from this interview for you?
Well, I mean, the real highlight for me was I just loved that moment when Helen asked Fauci if he'd talked to Biden, which is something a lot of people have been expecting. And Fauci had to think for a moment and then said, he hadn't talked to him since he was vice president back in the Obama administration. I just thought that also because of the moments in between them, which really were one of the amazing things about that interview. You could tell that Helen has been interacting with Fauci for many, many years.
Right. And, you know, Fauci, of course, is a legend in the infectious disease community, but in many ways, Helen is his equal as a reporter with decades of experience covering global health issues and infectious disease. And as you were just mentioning, Matt, I mean, these are two folks who have known each other for such a long time, and that mutual respect and admiration really came through in the interview.
Yeah. You know, at one point, Helen said that she was fearful that the vaccine news would be interpreted as kind of an immediate get out of COVID-19 jail card by Americans. And Fauci had a great response to that.
I know you are a worrier, but welcome to my life.
You know, I thought that was kind of really interesting and great personal moment between those two.
Helen also noted that Fauci is turning 80 on Christmas Eve. She asked him if he has considered retirement.
You know, I don't.
I'm not surprised by that answer.
No. The answer is I don't, because, you know, I think in terms of not numerical age, I think in terms of the energy you have and your capability. I actually think, I feel, and I'm pretty sure that I'm on the top of my game. When I feel that I'm not, and I have some honest people around me, like my wife, who is pretty good in judging me and my capabilities, that when I feel that I'm not able to give 100%, then I'll go off, but not now.
So Damian, you moderated a really interesting panel discussion that showed a different side of Nobel laureate Jennifer Doudna. She, of course, won that prize this year for her groundbreaking work as co-inventor of the CRISPR genome editing technology. But I really appreciated hearing her response to your question about the mentorship and support that she's provided to protégés from her lab who've moved on to form startups of their own, especially given that a career in science can mean a career facing a lot of failures.
Yeah, we were really happy to have Jennifer Doudna, obviously, but also Janice Chen and Benjamin Oakes, who are two alumni of her lab, who have gone on to start CRISPR-focused companies of their own, one in diagnostics in the form of Mammoth Biosciences and one in therapeutics in the form of Scribe Therapeutics. And yeah, it was really interesting, as you mentioned, to kind of see that other side of Jennifer Doudna and to kind of, I think she was maybe, you know, obviously, like many people, resistant to accepting compliments or patting herself on the back. But when you have two alumni, you can kind of twist the conversation such that she has no choice.
And in terms of giving Jennifer Doudna compliments, we gave her a very big one. She was also the winner of the second annual STAT Biomedical Innovation Award. I love Doudna's response to your question, Damien, when you asked her how she imparts upon her students the wonder of science to motivate them to go out and make discoveries, but also thickens their skin for when things don't pan out.
And I guess I feel like I try to lead by example. I don't lecture on that topic in my lab, as I think Janice and Ben could attest to, but I do try to provide a supportive environment. I like everyone in my lab to know that I have their back.
So Matt, now that this year's summit is over, what can we expect next year? What do you got cooking?
Well, Adam, actually, we're going to be doing three summits next year.
Oh my God, three?
And it's not a joke. Yes, in addition to our health tech and the STAT summit, we will be adding another one focused on science. And because of your success in the breakout sessions, you will now be doing all of the breakouts. I'm also hoping you can do that in a pink tutu on a unicycle.
Well, I hope I can do it live and not on a Zoom. So that's my hope.
That is what we're all hoping.
I think a pink tutu and a unicycle is just a Wednesday for Adam.
Well, Matt, again, great job on the summit, and thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
That does it for another episode of The Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Hyacinth Empanado, who produced this week's episode.
Alex Hogan is our senior producer, and Rick Burke is our executive producer.
And we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode, what you didn't like, and about the mentors you've had who, like Jennifer Doudna, have always had your back. You can do it all by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
And we'll be off next week for Thanksgiving, so we'll see you in 2 weeks.